Sounds True and Shambhala Lion Editions present A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber, Session 6, Approaching an Integral View.
In our final discussion, we want to bring all these pieces together into a truly integral view. We want to discuss an all-level, all-quadrant approach to consciousness, therapy, spirituality, and transformative practice, and we want to talk about the many obstacles in this integral view, obstacles which you call flatland. In order to do so, I wonder if you could give us the briefest possible summary of the overall discussion so far, a brief summary of the big picture up to this point.
Well, we started with emptiness, creativity, holons, or spirit creativity holons. In other words, out of emptiness, holons creatively emerge. As they emerge, they evolve. This evolution, or spirit in action, has certain features in common wherever it appears. These common features I have summarized as the 20 tenets, and we discussed a few of them. These are the patterns of manifestation. For example, we saw that all holons have four capacities: agency and communion, self-transcendence, and self-dissolution. Because of the self-transcending drive, new holons emerge. As they emerge holarchically. They transcend and include. Cells transcend and include molecules, which transcend and include atoms, and so on. Likewise, the self-transcending drive of the cosmos produces holons of greater and greater depth. And we saw that the greater the depth of a holon, the greater its degree of consciousness, among other things. But greater depth also means more things that can go wrong. Dogs get cancer, atoms don't. There's a dialectic of progress at every turn, hardly a sweetness and light affair. Holons not only have an inside and outside, they also exist as individuals and as collectives. This means that every holon has four facets, which we call the four quadrants: intentional, behavioral, cultural, and social. So we followed the evolution of the four quadrants up to the human forms of those quadrants, at which point humans themselves begin to reflect on these quadrants, think about them, notice that they themselves are embedded in them. And in this attempt to gain knowledge about their own situation, humans generate various knowledge quests, quests for truth. Since each of these four quadrants deals with a different aspect of holons, each of them has a different type of truth, a different validity claim. And humanity, through long and painful experimentation, slowly learned these validity tests, ways to ground knowledge in the realities of each quadrant. Since the two objective and exterior dimensions, the right-hand quadrants, can both be described in objective it language, we simplify the four quadrants to the big three: I, we, and it. Studied, for example, in self, morals, science, or art, self and self-expression, ethics, and objectivity, the beautiful, the good, and the true. In the spiritual domains, Buddha, Sangha, Dharma, the ultimate I, ultimate we, and ultimate it. We could simplify the big three even further. The left-hand dimensions, the I and the we, can only be accessed by introspection and interpretation, whereas the right hand delivers itself up to perception and empiricism, and those are the left and right hand paths. That is, the right hand aspects are the exteriors of holons, and so they can be seen empirically. But the intentional and cultural, the left hand quadrants, involve interior depth that can only be accessed by interpretation. Interpretation means, in the broadest sense, empathic resonance from within, as opposed to objective staring from without. Surfaces can be seen, but depth must be interpreted, and those are the right and left-hand paths. But those are all just ways to talk about these four facets of any holon. And the central point was, don't confuse these four quadrants. Simplify them, yes, but don't merely equate them, because these four quadrants, with their four different types of truth, are the basic facets of any holon, and reducing one to the others does not explain that quadrant, but simply destroys it. Therefore, as we followed the evolution of holons, we were careful to follow not only the exteriors of those holons, atoms, molecules, cells, organ systems, Gaia, etc. We also follow their correlative interiors, sensations, images, concepts, rules, right up to subtle and causal occasions. In short, we saw this interior evolution go from prepersonal to personal to transpersonal. And we saw that this interior evolution involves ladder, climber, and view, the ladder or basic levels or nested holarchy of consciousness, the climber or the self with a fulcrum at every stage, a 1-2-3 process of fusion, differentiation, integration, and the changing world views, archaic, magic, mythic, rational, etc., each of which produces a different self-identity, needs, and moral sense. Thus we saw self-identity needs and moral response go from physiocentric to biocentric to egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric, the platform for all higher and truly spiritual developments. And we saw that an accident at any of these stages produces a pathology characteristic of the stage where the accident occurs, psychosis, borderline, neurosis, script, etc. And finally, we looked specifically at the four higher stages and fulcrums, the four transpersonal stages, the psychic, the subtle, the causal, and the non-dual. We saw that each of these also has its own worldview, and therefore its own type of mysticism, namely nature mysticism, deity mysticism, formless mysticism, and non-dual mysticism. These higher stages are very rare, very difficult accomplishments. In the past, they were reached only by a small handful, the lone shaman, the yogi in the cave, the small sanghas and cloisters of the true seekers of wisdom. These deeper or higher states have never been anything near an average or collective mode of awareness. If we look at the evolution of the average mode, then we find something that stops at the centauric level and vision logic stage with global or world-centric morality, which is still an unrealized ideal for most. If these higher or transpersonal stages emerge in our future collective evolution, then they will manifest in all four quadrants, intentional, behavioral, cultural, and social. And we are awaiting the possible collective forms of this future evolution, even if individually we pursue these higher states in our own case. But the essential point is that at these higher or transpersonal stages, the spirit that was present throughout the entire revolutionary process becomes increasingly conscious of its own condition. It has gone from subconscious to self-conscious to superconscious, unfolding more of itself and enfolding more of itself at every stage. Spirit slumbers in nature, begins to awaken in mind, and finally recognizes itself as spirit in the transpersonal domains. But it is the same spirit present throughout the entire sequence, the ground, path, and fruition of the whole display. With spirit's shocking self-recognition, form continues to arise and evolve, but the secret is out. They are all forms of emptiness in the universe of one taste, endlessly transparent and utterly divine. There is no end limit, no foundation, no final resting place, only emptiness and endless grace. So the luminous play carries on with insanely joyous regard, timeless gesture to timeless gesture, radiant in its wild release, ecstatic in its perfect abandon, endless fullness beyond endless fullness, this miraculously self-liberating dance, and there is no one anywhere to watch it or even sing its praises.
Now what you just summarized is one type of integral view, which includes all of the quadrants, the I, we, and it dimensions, as they evolve through all the levels, from matter to body to mind to soul to spirit. Would you say that that type of integral view tends to be denied in the West, and often in the East as well, because either some of the levels or some of the quadrants are left out?
Oh yes, especially in the modern West. We can't help but notice that all of the higher transpersonal spiritual levels of consciousness are looked upon with grave suspicion and even outright hostility. In fact, The worldview of scientific materialism, which is the official worldview of the modern West, aggressively denies not only the higher stages of consciousness development, but the existence of consciousness itself.
And you call this flatland.
That's right, flatland. Either in the form of subtle reductionism, which reduces every interior or left-hand event to its exterior or right-hand correlate, or worse, gross reductionism, which reduces every right-hand system to right-hand atoms. In either case, the entire left-hand domains are denied irreducible reality. There is no consciousness, no mind, no soul, no spirit, no value, no depth, and no divinity found anywhere in the disqualified universe. Only a great web of interwoven its, or even worse, atomistic its. A truly insane worldview, wouldn't you say?
Sounds true enough. Could you trace this historical rise of flatland?
The great holarchy, the developmental path of mind to body to soul to spirit, has been part of the cultural background of most humans for most of our history. That is, right up until the Enlightenment in the West. With the fundamental Enlightenment paradigm, all of reality, including the great holarchy, was mapped in empirical and monological terms. This was a well-intentioned but deeply confused attempt to understand consciousness and morals and values and meaning by putting them under the microscope of the monological gaze. And you know what happened? The interior depths completely disappeared from view. They could not be found with a monological gaze, and so they were soon pronounced non-existent or illusory or derivative or epiphenomenal, all polite words for not really real. All I's and all we's were reduced to mere its, atomistic or holistic, depending upon your prejudice, but all of which had only, at best, functional fit. None of these interwoven its can be said to be better or deeper or higher or more valuable. Just equally flat and endlessly faded surfaces scurrying about in objective systems, not one of which has the slightest clue as to value or depth or quality or goodness or beauty or worth.
In other words, flatland.
We have flatland. We looked at this as good news, bad news. The good news of modernity was that the big three were differentiated: art, science, morals. The bad news was that they had not yet been integrated, and this allowed an explosive science to colonize and dominate the I and the we domains. Thus, the downside of the Enlightenment was that it reduced all left-hand dimensions to their right-hand correlates, and it thought that a simple mapping of these empirical exteriors was all the knowledge that was worth knowing, the mirror of nature, the representation paradigm. This left out the mapmaker itself, the consciousness, the interiors, the left-hand dimensions, and resulted in nothing but the flat and faded surfaces of a brutally monochrome world. And so, following John Locke, the teacher of the Enlightenment, the great modern mapping game was afoot. Map the entire cosmos in empirical terms. And a century or so into this game of converting the entire cosmos into objective its, the Enlightenment agenda awoke one morning to find to its utter horror that it was living in a thoroughly disqualified universe, a universe absolutely bereft of value, meaning, consciousness, quality, and worth. In mapping exterior correlates, it had gutted all interior depth, had eviscerated the interiors, and laid them out to dry in the blazing sun of the monological gaze. And so, slowly, in an atmosphere of puzzled confusion, the bloodless corpse of the Enlightenment agenda was wheeled into the morgue, and the postmodern rebellion began. Postmodern, post-enlightenment, post-empirical, post-whatever. Something had gone profoundly, profoundly wrong.
The collapse of the cosmos.
Yes. The monological agenda had, in one sweeping action, completely collapsed the interior dimensions of being and consciousness and depth. It had, in other words, completely collapsed the great holarchy of consciousness. Whether pre-personal, personal, or transpersonal, you cannot find consciousness with a monological gaze. You cannot see it with a microscope, a telescope, a photographic plate. And so it must not exist. It must not be really real. And that's basically why it is only with the modern West that we do not have access to the great holarchy.
Your historical research of this collapse of the cosmos seems to challenge several long-standing myths about the Western tradition, starting with Plato.
There are essentially two major directions in which you can move in this great holarchy. You can ascend from matter to spirit, or you can descend from spirit to matter. Upward is very transcendent, downward is very immanent. Ascending is very otherworldly, descending is very thisworldly.
Now this is where you introduce the ascending and descending currents of spirituality.
That's right. The first movement, the ascending movement, is a movement from the many to the one, a movement where we see that behind the fleeting and shadowy forms of manifestation, there is a single source, a groundless ground, the absolute, and we rise to an understanding of this absolute good.
So we ascend in that sense.
Yes. But the other movement is equally important in Plato, namely, the movement whereby the One empties itself into all creation, gives itself to all forms, so that all of creation itself is a perfect manifestation of spirit. So this world, this very earth, Plato called a visible, sensible God.
The descent, then, of the One into the many.
Yes, exactly. Now, it's indeed true that Plato gave the West most of its otherworldly philosophy. But as Arthur Lovejoy is at pains to demonstrate, Plato also gave the West virtually all of the terms for its this-worldly exuberance and celebration, the celebration of the visible, sensible God. The entire manifest world was seen as a manifestation or embodiment of the good, of the absolute, and was to be celebrated as such. The greater the diversity in the world, the greater the spiritual glory and goodness. And indeed, most of the this-worldly philosophies of the West have their origin in Plato. Listen to Lovejoy. The most notable and the less noted fact about Plato's historic influence is that he did not merely give to European otherworldliness its characteristic form and phraseology and dialectic, but that he also gave the characteristic form and phraseology and dialectic to precisely the contrary tendency, to a particularly exuberant kind of this-worldliness. And as Lovejoy concludes, both of these currents, ascending and descending, or otherworldly and this-worldly, or transcendent and immanent, were united and integrated in Plato. As Lovejoy puts it, the two strands in Plato's thought are here fused. Ascending and descending are united and integrated, and that's Plato's final stance, as it were. Now, what happened in subsequent history is that these two strands were brutally torn apart. There was a violent rupture between the advocates of mere ascent and the advocates of mere descent. These two currents, which in fact ought to be united and integrated, were catastrophically fractured into the ascenders versus the descenders.
So the hallmark of an integral view would be the integration of both these ascending and descending currents?
Oh yes, definitely. Whitehead's famous comment that the Western tradition is basically a series of footnotes to Plato may be true, but the footnotes were fractured. People tended to take their favorite half of Plato, the otherworldly or the thisworldly, but rarely did they take the whole. We don't have to settle for the fractured footnotes to Plato. The ascending and descending currents were united in Plato, and they were likewise united in Plotinus.
But things begin to fall apart after Plotinus.
Well, in a sense, yes. It's generally agreed that Plotinus was fleshing out the essentials of Plato in a more comprehensive fashion. And in Plotinus, we have the great holarchy of being, and we have the two basic movements in this nested holarchy, namely ascending and descending, or what Plotinus calls reflux and efflux. Spirit constantly effluxes or empties itself into the world, so that the entire world and all its inhabitants are perfect manifestations of spirit. And likewise, the world constantly returns or refluxes to spirit, so that this entire world is itself spiritual to the core, the visible, sensible God. According to Plotinus, each senior dimension in the great holarchy transcends and includes its junior, so that each and every thing and event, without exception, is perfectly nested in spirit, in the One, which is therefore the seamless integration and union of ascent and descent, reflux and efflux, transcendence and immanence.
You point out that this becomes very clear in Plotinus's attack on the Gnostics.
Yes, that's right. Most of the Gnostics were mere ascenders. Any form of descent was, in fact, equated with evil. So the entire manifest world, this world, was thought to be illusory, shadowy, corrupted, sinful. Only by ascending to the One and shunning the many could salvation be found. If Plotinus, carrying the Platonic torch, were really otherworldly, you would expect him to join with the Gnostics and celebrate their merely ascending agenda and attack all this-worldly endeavors. Instead, Plotinus began an absolutely devastating attack on the Gnostics, on these mere ascenders, precisely because they couldn't balance the ascending current with the equally important descending current. In other words, the Gnostics had found the causal one, but they didn't push through to the non-dual realization that the one and the many are not two, that emptiness and form are non-dual, that this-worldly and otherworldly are one taste, that the ascending and descending currents need to be integrated in the non-dual heart. And so Plotinus tears into the Gnostics with an extraordinary and altogether convincing attack, and in some of the most beautiful spiritual prose ever written, reminds the Gnostics that this entire visible world is a manifestation of spirit and is to be loved as spirit. And if they, the Gnostics, really loved spirit, as they proclaim, then they would love spirit's children, whereas they merely despise them.
Now you quote that attack in Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality. Could you read it for us?
Here, Plotinus is speaking. Do not suppose that a man becomes good by despising the world and all the beauties that are in it. They, the Gnostics, have no right to profess respect for the gods of the world above. When we love a person, we love all that belongs to him. We extend to the children the affection we feel for the parent. Now, every soul is a daughter of spirit. How can this world be separated from the spiritual world? Those who despise what is so nearly akin to the spiritual world prove that they know nothing of the spiritual world except in name. Let any individual soul make itself worthy to contemplate the great soul by ridding itself, through quiet recollection, of deceit or untruthfulness, and of all that bewitches vulgar souls. For it, let all be quiet. Let all its environment be at peace. Let the earth be quiet, and the sea and air, and the heaven itself waiting. Let it observe how the soul flows in from all sides into the resting world, pours itself into it, penetrates it, and illumines it. Even as the bright beams of the sun enlighten a dark cloud and give it a golden border, so the soul, when it enters into the body of the heaven, gives it life and timeless beauty and awakens it from sleep. So the world, grounded in a timeless movement by the soul which suffuses it with intelligence, becomes a living and blessed being. It, soul or spirit, gives itself to every point in this vast body and vouchsafes its being to every part, great and small, though these parts are divided in space and manner of disposition, and though some are opposed to each other, others dependent on each other. But the soul is not divided, nor does it split up in order to give life to each individual. All things live by the soul in its entirety, i.e., ultimately, there are no degrees, no levels, but simply pure presence. It is all present everywhere. The heaven, vast and various as it is won by the power of the soul, and by it is this universe of ours divine. The sun, too, is divine, and so are the stars. And we ourselves, if we are worth anything, are so on account of the soul. Be persuaded that by it thou can attain to God, and know that thou wilt not have to go far afield.
So that clearly shows the non-dual orientation of Plotinus, and you relate this integration of ascent and descent to the union of wisdom and compassion?
Yes, we see this in both East and West. The path of ascent from the many to the one is the path of wisdom. Wisdom sees that behind all the multifarious forms and phenomena, there lies the One, the Good, the unqualifiable emptiness, against which all forms are seen to be illusory, fleeting, impermanent. Wisdom is the return of the many to the One. In the East, Prajna, or wisdom, sees that form is emptiness. The path of descent, on the other hand, is the path of compassion. It sees that the One actually manifests as the many, and so all forms are to be treated equally with kindness, compassion, mercy. Compassion or goodness is, in fact, the very mechanism of manifestation itself. The One manifests as the many through an infinite act of compassion and charity, and we embrace the many with that same compassion and care. Compassion touches all manifestation with concern and gentle wonderment. In the East, Karuna, or compassion, sees that emptiness is form. So we have wisdom sees that the many is one, and compassion sees that the one is the many. Or in the East, Prajna sees that form is emptiness, Karuna sees that emptiness is form.
This concludes Side A.